So I know some of our guests are coming in from Asia. So it's Friday morning where you are. Thank you for starting your day with us. And of course, on the East Coast, 8 o'clock. And here in beautiful British Columbia, we're just after the 5 o'clock hour. So welcome to the program, everybody. I'm John Weston, and today we relaunched the Things That Matter series. Thank you for people who are tuning in from all over the world, including clients, government officials, people I served as a member of parliament, friends, and others who just want to grapple some of the big issues of our time. And the issues that we're tackling are really big ones, ones which call on our rights and responsibilities as citizens. And for me, and maybe for you, the question is, can we even make a difference on large, complex issues like the one we're talking about today, promoting peace and democracy in the Taiwan Straits? To help us tackle such things in a meaningful and relevant way, I've invited great, insightful panelists like the ones we have tonight, and I'm looking forward to introducing you both in just a second. Before doing that, let me thank the fine people on the Pan-Pacific team who helped produce this series. That's Dana McLeod, Elliot Harada, and Tom Annable. And let's also just take a quick glimpse at upcoming episodes. I'd like you to just have a look at what we have in store for you. Next month, the episode will deal with choosing your heroes, a vital component of good leadership. And that's with business leader and author Dave Bentall and Olympian and coach Lynn Kanuka. And you can see there some of the other topics and panelists that we've got in store for the months to come. So if you want to put questions through the chat, then please do so, and I'll do my best to bring them into the flow. But I have to say that we've got a really full set of issues to talk about, and so please forgive me if I don't get to your question during the show. Well, tensions involving Taiwan, China, and the world are deepening. Up until 2016, discussions of unifying China and Taiwan had been mostly of a peaceful nature with emphasis on economic and diplomatic maneuvering. But the tempo and temperature have changed. China's military maneuvers have become increasingly provocative. Vladimir Putin's horrible invasion has provided Xi Jinping an active blueprint of what to expect when a large, powerful country attacks its neighbor. And I offer a special welcome to Ukrainian friends who have joined our audience tonight. We support and pray for peace in your nation. Interviewed on 60 Minutes, President Biden said in September that American forces would defend Taiwan if China attacked. In the same month, Canadian and U.S. warships sailed through the Taiwan Straits. By the way, that was the second time they'd done that in a year. And though both countries called the sailings routine, China reacted angrily. Also in September, I spent 2 weeks in Taiwan, and I have to say, what a difference from the place where I lived for a decade between 86 and 97. Air quality has improved, infrastructure is better, transportation's fantastic. You can rent a bicycle on every second block. And for the most part, people seem happy, subject to the anxiety relating to the issues that we're talking about tonight. When I was in Taiwan, I met with defense officials and former President Ma Ying-jeou. It was astonishing to learn about the level of hostile cyber activity conducted by the government of China against Taiwan and democratic countries, including Canada. Canadian policy on China and Taiwan is vague and shifting. When politicians are uncertain, appointed officials hold sway. So here's the question. What should we as citizens be doing to encourage our elected leaders to develop a clear, sound, and effective foreign policy that promotes peace and democracy in the Taiwan Straits? Angel Liu, you did a master's at Johns Hopkins on China studies. You worked in the key Taiwan government agencies that focus on China relations. You've been posted in the U.S., and rising star that you are, you arrived in October last year in Vancouver, where you head Taiwan's Foreign Service delegation in Vancouver as the Director General of the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office. welcome to the show.
Thank you. Should I start?
Please, Angel.
Okay. I will do a little bit introduction of what I'm going to say for 3 minutes to 5 minutes. Good evening, Vancouver, and good morning, Taipei. It's good to meet you all virtually at John Weston's Things That Matter podcast. And thank you, John, for the invitation to have dialogues with one of the most recognized scholars on China issues in Canada, Mr. Jonathan Manthorpe. The topic is important to us is maintaining a peaceful and stable Taiwan Strait while promoting democracy. This is important not only to Taiwan, but countries which do business in the region. That's why recently the G7 Leaders Summit, Foreign Ministers Meeting, ASEAN Foreign Ministers Meeting, Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, European Parliament, and Australia, UK, and United States Trilateral Nuclear Talks, the EU-Japan Leaders Summit. Almost all high-level international meetings have their joint statements in urging PRC to exercise its restraint on its provocative actions toward Taiwan. The wrap-up of the 20th Party Congress of the Chinese Communist Party earlier has further proved that China has become a totalitarian state, not only authoritarianism. It is the one main country controlled by Xi Jinping, not only because he has unprecedentedly obtained the presidency for the third term, but also recruit people who are loyal to him, but not necessarily professional and outstanding for their work performance in the past to the Politburo. Over half of the Politburo members have had experiences dealing with Taiwan issues or have visited Taiwan before. And the military members of his Politburo are with experiences in southeastern military region. Judging from these, it is worrisome that Xi Jinping will push further his agenda of unification with Taiwan without ruling out possibility of using military force. As Xi Jinping's authority comes under stress from domestic challenges relating to declining economic growth, which many people associated with his zero-COVID policy, and multiple potential economic crises, such as rising unemployment, real estate market crash, ballooning local debts, et cetera, Xi Jinping may feel greater pressure to demonstrate progress in tilting the cross-strait status quo in Beijing's preferred direction. Its power projection even goes beyond Taiwan Strait to East China Sea, South China Sea, the Pacific Ocean, and Indian Ocean to the entire world. The PRC philosophy is not just expansion of Chinese influence, it's expansion of authoritarianism. Take the COP27 meeting, for example. It's a UNFCCC meeting, which is now taking place in Egypt. In the past, China avoids mentioning of Taiwan at the climate change summit and vigorously opposed Taiwan's attempts to participate in international forums. But this year, the Chinese delegate, Xie Zhenhua, took a new approach to Beijing's claim of jurisdiction by offering help Taiwan's goals to achieve the 2015 net zero emissions far exceeds China's commitment. So we don't know what kind of help they can offer, but it is just to try to express their intention to annex Taiwan. I know John has some questions to link today's dialogues. I would like to give the microphone to our moderator for today's program.
Well, thank you, Angel. And, you know, your remarks underline the difficult balancing act. You're a diplomat. You are trying to encourage exchange between Canada and Taiwan. And meanwhile, there's this backdrop of rising anxiety. Well, thank you for that introduction. Well, Jonathan Manthorpe, you're one of the top foreign affairs writers Canada has ever produced. And you've been at journalism for an astounding 55 years, although it doesn't show. You've reported for the Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, and the Southern Group. You've written, I was going to say, two books that were directly relevant to our topic tonight, but just before we got going, you reminded me of a third, So let me just touch on those briefly. There is a must read for anybody who wants to understand the history of Taiwan in terms of its economic, political, cultural, and linguistic developments. It's called Forbidden Nation: A History of Taiwan. That's a 2009 book. And then more recently, in 2019, you published Claws of the Panda. And by the way, I would hold it up, except I gave it to my son, who actually has it, but I see it behind you. It's a haunting revelation of how China has inserted itself into academic, social, and the financial life of Canada. And then there's a third book, which is
Restoring Democracy in
who's
an Age of Pestilence. A little alliterative, I'm afraid.
And that was 2020, so you continue to be fairly prolific. And among other many influential roles you've held, and this goes beyond your life as an author, and it's very germane to our discussion tonight, you were a member of the 2003 Canada-Japan Forum. I hope we get to touch on that later. So welcome to Things That Matter, Jonathan.
Thank you very much, John, and thank you for the invitation to this. I agree with the rather gloomy picture, but I've actually become a little more optimistic in the last few weeks about the situation than I was before. I think the midterms in the U.S. have, for the moment, shelved that rather disastrous scenario prospect that Houston. The Republicans won a strong majority in the House and the Senate, but support for Ukraine and support for Taiwan might weaken. There's clearly not a prospect of that at the moment. There's going to be have to be negotiations to make the U.S. government work, and that's a good thing. It may be the entry of a new age. At the same time, I think that the 20th Party Congress has woken up the world to the fact that the People's Republic of China is now an authoritarian state, a totalitarian state. I mean, if it was a European country, we'd probably call it a fascist state. And one sees all over the world countries and businesses becoming more and more hesitant in their dealings with People's Republic of China. Now, this could be a two-edged sword. It could make Xi Jinping and Beijing and the Chinese Communist Party feel isolated, feel constrained, and perhaps encourage them to lash out. I'm not sure that their military capability is such that they could successfully or hope to successfully invade Taiwan. I think the war has been a lesson for everyone that with modern high technology, the capacity for even a relatively small population to defend itself is much greater than we ever thought. From some of the things that Xi Jinping said, I think theory. He doesn't really expect his military to be of world class until perhaps the mid 2030s or more likely 2050. So I think we have some time to deal with these pressures or to try to deal with these pressures. We also, from the Canadian point of view, of course, we've seen a fairly dramatic change in attitude. The Minister of Foreign Affairs just in the last few days warning businesses about dealing with People's Republic of China. And we've had the Prime Minister railing against PRC and CCP interference in our elections. And we've had Chrystia Freeland, the Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Finance, saying that in the future, Canada needs to strengthen its relationships with countries with which we share values of civic, security, international values, of which clearly Taiwan is one of the leading countries in Asia. I will leave it there and let you lead the discussion, John.
Well, I like the spirit of optimism for sure. And if anything, I hope it encourages our audience members to ask ourselves, what can we do as individual citizens? You know, when issues are big and complex, it's tempting for individuals to feel a sense of paralysis, to step back and just say, well, there's nothing that we can do. There's nothing we can do to affect our governments or even more complex international affairs. So do you have any sense of what Canada and Canadian citizens can do to play a role to promote democracy and peace in the Taiwan Straits? And Jonathan, why don't we start with you? And
well, you mentioned that I was part of the Canada Forum 2003 to 2006. So this was a forum appointed by the two prime ministers. So it had profile. And it was a message to officials and to businesses. Prime ministers thought that this was one of the things that we tried to do at the very beginning was to try to quantify the level of the relationship between Canada and Japan. Very quickly found that we couldn't. It was too diverse, it was too massive, it was so many people to people links that they just didn't come up with any register anywhere. And I think that showed that I mean, it was everything from flower raging groups to Taekwondo to fishing groups, everything you can imagine. And I think that this shows that when you have like-minded countries, the interaction between ordinary citizens and their local little organizations can have a profound effect in deepening and broadening the relationship. And so, it may sound trite and silly, but we have orchids in common between the Vancouver or British Columbia and Taiwan. And I bet you that if you looked, you'd find that there are all sorts of organizations and people who are exchanging information and working back and forth on something like orchids. But I think that citizens just making a link, it may be through a discussion group, through anything. Those people-to-people relationships really matter, and in the end they count, because they build a relationship that becomes strong at the national level.
And I hope we come back to this. And when I was in Taiwan as recently as September, I found an overwhelming energy of generosity and sharing ideas. People felt that Canada was a like-minded country. As a Canadian, I felt that I had ready access to people in high positions of authority that you wouldn't expect. And there was an outreach waiting to happen. So yours is a very specific idea that could be cultivated into a very specific kind of a forum. And I don't want to lose track of this, because I think if some very specific ideas come out of this discussion tonight, then we would be doing a service to not just peace and democracy in the Taiwan Straits, but to the country. Angel, do you want to expand on that? The topic is, what can Canada do? What can Canadians do to play a role?
My sense for the Taiwan-Canada relations after 1 year I arrived in Vancouver is that we need stronger and explicit support from the Canadian government, whether it is federal or provincial, beyond the sensitivity of geopolitics and the complication between Canadian and Canada and China, the complicated relations between Canada and China. So we could pursue from non-sensitive areas such as trade, economic, education, indigenous affairs, and cultural. But how can the strong people-to-people ties and the shared values of democracy, freedom, and respect for human rights be reflected in Canada's policy toward Taiwan is the utmost that we want to pursue while I'm here. There is no doubt that Canadians share the values with Taiwan, but they are just not reflected in the Canadian policy. So from our expectation for Canadian government to pursue forging a closer ties with Taiwan, it's like what Jonathan just mentioned, a little bit optimistic because of the foreign minister, Meng Jolie, said the day before in University of Toronto that, Canada want to have closer ties with Taiwan, economic ties with Taiwan. She explicitly said that, in addition to saying that engaging at the highest levels to oppose the Chinese government's human rights abuses in places such as Xinjiang and Hong Kong, as well as threats against Taiwan. And Canada will add dedicated experts to key embassies in Asia to support understanding of the challenges that China poses and the opportunities that it presents. So we are glad to hear what Foreign Minister Jolie said. And what else can Canada help Taiwan to keep a peace and stable Taiwan Strait? I think the Canadian warship, which joined the U.S. in sailing through the Taiwan Strait, as John just mentioned in your introduction, is very important to us. And as this routine Taiwan Strait transit demonstrates Canadians' commitment to a free and open and inclusive Indo-Pacific. And we need to see that continue Canadian government continue to do that. And also another important point is, I think the closer trade relations between Taiwan and Canada and the world actually would raise the cost of such a military conflict initiated by China. Therefore, we urge the Canadian government to start the negotiation of a bilateral investment agreement as soon as possible without any hesitation or consideration, and support Taiwan's application into the multilateral free trade agreement in Asia Pacific, which is called a Comprehensive Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPTPP. And another point is that Alberta Member of Parliament Michael Cooper, he introduced a very important act last year in the Parliament. It's called Taiwan-Canada Relations Framework Act. We are looking forward to have that to be passed in this year's session, because in the act it includes forging closer support for Taiwan to join international mechanisms such as WHO, UNFCCC, and Interpol, etc., for Taiwanese technical experts to joined a lot of technical meetings in these multilateral international forums, and also to let Taiwan's delegation to have a more engagement with like-minded countries. So I think that's what I think Canada government can do.
I would back everything that Angel has said on. But I would particularly underline her point that Canada should join with others to back Taiwan's membership of the CPTPP. I think that there's a good chance of that happening. I'm sure Japan, which is the leading country in that group at the moment, I'm sure Japan would support it, and I bet most of the others would as well. So I think that's certainly something Canada should do. I also think that maybe we should look at perhaps something like a middle power forum, which would include Taiwan and other middle power democracies, on how to, and a series of discussions on how to protect and grow democracies in this age in which we live. And this book here is really about how we failed after the end of the Cold War to realize that other threats could come at our democratic institutions. And I think we need to be far more attuned to the possibility of that happening again. Indeed, it's sort of underway all the time. But the middle power democracies like Canada and Taiwan can and should, I think, get together to talk about these issues in fora that have some public public strength and that so people can get involved with. I think that would be something that I would strongly recommend.
Well, thank you both for those. Several ideas coming out of that. The Japan-Canada Forum model sounds like something that could be adapted, especially if it was a province that took the lead. You know, listeners tonight who aren't as familiar with these issues as you are will be confounded. Why aren't we doing this already? What's wrong? What's holding Canada back? Well, traditionally, there's been this one China policy that has been interpreted by some to mean that you can't engage with Taiwan for fear of offending this so-called One China policy. And there's many ways that you can observe a One China policy and still support the democracy, freedom, and peace that we're talking about this evening. So this idea that you've raised, Jonathan, tonight, Canada, Japan, it's been done before, maybe can be replicated. Very interesting, Angel, to hear your comments because you contrast so vividly against the recent Beijing ambassador in Ottawa, who was so strident and so unrelenting in his criticism of Canada and Canadians. He called this a puppet of the United States. And your commentary is, how can Canada engage more effectively in Taiwan so Taiwan can contribute more to Canada? By contrast, his commentary was to demean Canada and our democracy and our other relationships and our respect for the rule of law. So a vivid contrast there. Let's move on to an issue that really affects all of us. I know there's some people on the line tonight who are particularly interested in the world of cybersecurity and cyber war. And what I found astounding in my meetings with defense officials and the heads of NGOs in Taiwan as recently as September was the level of hostile cyber activity that is being conducted by state-sponsored groups in China. So one reliable source advised that there are some 43 groups in China, each staffed by 600 to 800 people, who've got no other mandate but to spread disinformation, to interfere with electoral processes in democratic countries, and even to possibly attack infrastructure in other countries by means of cyber war. So why don't we start, Angel, with you? I mean, what do you see as this? And let me add that David Vigneault, who's the head of CSIS, that's Canada's top intelligence official, has been clearer than I've ever heard any intelligence officer before in labeling China as Canada's biggest cybersecurity threat. So those are not comforting words, but I'm hoping, Angel, that you might have some helpful thoughts about this cyber concern that is growing for all of us. Angel, over to you, and we'll let you go first on this one.
Okay. I think the cybersecurity threat is only part of China's gray zone tactics that it launched toward Taiwan. Apart from military exercises, Beijing also closed its markets to over 1,000 categories of Taiwanese products in a gross violation of WTO rules, and has launched this kind of gray zone tactics such as cognitive warfare, disinformation campaign, as well as cyber attacks in Taiwanese society after the U.S. Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taiwan. Upon she landed in Taiwan, our foreign ministry, as well as the office of the president's website, has received a massive distributive denial of service cyber attacks and forcing our websites offline temporarily. And in some convenience store screens behind the cashiers, it suddenly displays the words, "Warmonger Pelosi, get out of Taiwan," that kind of silly words that we'll never think of it. And the sole purpose of these malicious actions is to weaken the people's trust on the Taiwanese government, to increase the support of reunification with China, or we call it annexation, and to sow confusion and suspicion against the Western countries' perspective in Taiwan. So the less support Taiwan gets from the international society, the easier China can realize its dream of great rejuvenation of Chinese nation. However, the one country, two systems formula that is proposed by the PRC government to Taiwanese people is not attractive to Taiwanese at all, as we don't want a rubber stamp type of Congress. And we know that it will turn out to be one country, one system, which we all have witnessed in Hong Kong. And Taiwan is on the front lines of China's worldwide cyber war. And we are responding by bolstering our cyber resilience. The war in Ukraine has heightened our sense of urgency by demonstrating that a country under attack cannot necessarily rely on foreign governments. So we are preparing for that by all means, including elevating our national defense capacity, developing our asymmetrical war capacity, and also to build our digital infrastructure and satellite capacity to in case China launched a blockade to Taiwan surround the Indo, like what it did after Speaker Pelosi's visit, to fire the live fire military and missile attacks in waters surrounding Taiwan that mimic a real blockade. So we are preparing to defend our own country.
Just to underline how complex these things are, you referred a couple of times to Nancy Pelosi. Most of our audience will know she's the Speaker of the House in the United States and was the highest ranking American official in 25 years to visit Taiwan. She visited August 4th, and that unleashed this massive backlash from China, which suggested that her visit to Taiwan somehow interfered with the one China policy and China's sovereignty over Taiwan. Personally, for what it's worth, I thought it was an unnecessary, provocative thing for the United States to do, to send Nancy Pelosi to Taiwan. But the backlash was a very vivid illustration of how tight is this tightrope that Taiwan walks. One little misstep, and then look at the backlash. So, Jonathan, what are your thoughts about this whole cyber secure?
My most of my experience in this area is slightly tangential in that it's mostly to do with Chinese language media. And over the past 25 years, Beijing and its various operations, particularly the United Work Department, have invested a huge amount of time and resources in gaining editorial control of pretty well every Chinese language media outlet, newspaper, TV, radio, and now online news platforms that there is worldwide. I was astonished. I was astonished when I was in Taipei the end of 2019, just ahead of the elections in 2020, to see that most of the media in Taiwan is now controlled by either directly by Beijing or by business people, by publishers who also have large economic investments in China and are therefore susceptible to being leaned on by the United Front and other political warfare organizations. The situation here in Canada is the same. Now, pretty well every Chinese language news outlet is controlled, editorially controlled by Beijing. The same is true in the United States and Australia and other countries around the world with significant Chinese diaspora. This is really important in the last few years because we have been getting most of our ethnic Chinese immigrants from mainland China. From say Taiwan, where from Hong Kong, where they have experience of free and open media, how that works. A lot of the people coming to Canada from the PRC have no experience of free and open media.
Just in recent days, there's been a report issued about direct interference in the 2019 Canadian federal election. And as a candidate in the 2021 federal election myself, it was really clear how the presence on WeChat, which is the most universally accessed forum for people of Chinese language background, that the Conservative Party was completely absent on WeChat, and so allowed opponents to sow seeds of concern, discord, raise questions about what that party might do if it ever attained power, and there was no answer. So on one hand, I fault the Conservative Party itself for not having a greater presence where it should have been, but we saw evidence in both 2021 and recently released evidence about 2019.
Yep.
And you've gone into this at some length in your book, Claws of the Panda.
Yep.
Maybe you want to update us from where you
were. No, I mean, there's Claws of the Panda came out before that was last election. I think that the allegation now is that there are about 20 seats in the last election, last federal election, where Chinese language media was candidates very strongly and backed some who were backed candidates who were in favor of Beijing and strongly opposed candidates who were Beijing might be a problem or might oppose Beijing policies. I referred in Claws of the Panda to some earlier examples, and it seems to be building. The United Front Work Department, the political warfare organization, seems to be getting more and more assertive and aggressive in its political campaigns in Canada. It's not just in federal elections, of course, it's also in provincial and municipal elections that this organization is using Chinese language media to attempt determine the outcome of our elections. And this, of course, was the thing that that Justin Trudeau was so angry about in public the other day. And of course, it's come up with I think that there's a committee of the House of Commons is going to investigate it. I got an invitation today from them to go and give evidence. So it's being taken very seriously here, and quite rightly so.
Angel, are you at liberty to comment on this about possible interference in Canadian elections?
Yes, actually, the disinformation warfare that China launched for Taiwan or Canada is the same type of warfare, and it has investment on certain candidates and to get them in, help them get elected, and put some personnel and staff into the political candidate's office after you get win the election, and to interfere and influence Canadian politics. I think it's a disruption of Canadian democracy, and so is the meaning for its disinformation warfare on Taiwan. I think China's disinformation warfare has taken place in every municipal election in Taiwan, not only presidential election, but local election. The only purpose, again, is to help its favorite candidates to win the election and to promote the unification with Taiwan under the Chinese PRC's sovereignty.
Well, and you know, this is where I think the Canadian posture may be, what can we learn from Taiwan? When I went to those meetings in September, my question was, you're on the front line. You know what's going on way more than we do in Canada because you're confronting it on a much more pervasive basis. Taiwan has NGOs that are really not replicated in Canada. I know Anita and others are on the line tonight from the Taiwan Democracy Foundation. That's a very interesting agency, and we've got a lot to learn from some of the agencies and the processes that are alive in Taiwan. I published an article that ran in the Taipei Times Monday that just suggested maybe we Canadians shouldn't be talking about how can we help Taiwan, but what can we learn from Taiwan in these areas?
One thing we can learn, I think, is to enact a law to restrict and prohibit foreign interference in our political processes. Taiwan has such a law. Australia has such a law. We've got one, but it's very vague, and it doesn't seem to be used much. Our problem, of course, is it's not just China that interferes in Canadian politics.
So just remember to mute your mic, sorry, John.
Who depend on money from organizations in the United States. Right. We also have, for example, the Indian government very active here because of our immigration, or our immigrant populations from Punjab and so forth. And there are others. So we are in a, I can understand why politicians hesitate to introduce a really bill with teeth that would try to deal with political interference in Canada. But I think we have to do it. I mean, I think it's bad enough that we allow so many United States organizations to trot around dispensing money to various groups here in Canada. Hopefully, the example of the PRC and the United Frontier will give politicians some time and make them act, because I think influenced by the United States, just as unhealthy and despicable as it is from anywhere else.
Angel, you're a very polite person, and you know you've been genteel in describing some notable deficiencies in our Canadian foreign policy. But I can be a little more direct. I was astonished from what I learned in Taiwan that our government currently prohibits members of our intelligence agency, CSIS, and our Defense Department from working directly with Taiwan counterparts. I mean, why wouldn't we go to the place where so much is happening on a daily basis and learn from the people who are charged with this responsibility? I don't know if you feel comfortable in commenting on that. Let me go further. You've mentioned the CPTPP, that's a horrible acronym, where Canada should be supporting Taiwan's role. There's also the Global Cooperation and Training Framework. It's a group that's initiated by Taiwan. I think because it's been initiated by Taiwan, there's some aberrant Canadian foreign policy that said, well, maybe Canadians shouldn't be active in that. There must be low-hanging fruit, places where Canada can cooperate more effectively with Taiwan and still respect the One China policy. Any thoughts about
that? Yeah, actually, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau already publicly stated that Canada's policy to support Taiwan's meaningful participation in multilateral mechanisms such as WHO in May this year. So since Canadian government has publicly supported Taiwan's international participation, why not GCTF? It is just an MOU signing between Taiwan and the United States in the beginning, and then followed by Japan and Australia. Now four countries already become the four partners in GCTF framework, Global Cooperation on Training Framework. Although Canada has not become a full partner of it, but it does participate in one of the gender equality forum last October in Taipei. Then CDOT executive director participated in it. We were glad that he did. But we are looking forward to further action taken by the Canadian government to become a full member of that. Actually, it is a platform supported by the MOU between partner countries to utilize Taiwan's strengths and expertise to address global issues of mutual concern, And the forum has allowed Taiwan to build up its partnerships with regional countries and further expand its international presence. So again, go back to my sense that Canada can push further to engage closer with Taiwan in this respect.
Can I just stay on that, John? A lot of this is just a matter of attitude. To say we have a one China policy is a bit of an exaggeration. We don't in the way the US does. We have been absolutely silent on the relationship between the PRC and Taiwan since the very beginning, since 1970, when we opened diplomatic relations. Unlike the United States, which acknowledged China's or the PRC's claim to Taiwan, we only noted it. And so when we talk about, and you talk about quite rightly, restrictions on Canadian diplomats and so forth, this is a matter of attitude. There is actually nothing in law or in documents or in our treaties that restricts us having whatever relationship with Taiwan that we want. But because of this notion that's built up, as I set out in the blog post, the People's Republic of China has a special friendship with Canada. And this has been the basis of this sort of infiltration of agents of influence in the letters of Canadian government, of business, and of academia. This notion has been built into the Canadian establishment that you mustn't offend Beijing. Well, the Huawei affair, the two Canadians, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, were kidnapped by the Chinese Communist Party in retaliation for our application of a request by the U.S. Justice Department to detain the chief financial officer of Huawei Technologies. That should have said to everybody, and I think the message is finally getting in, PRC is not a friend of Canada. And I think that that is now beginning to force a re-examination of the relationship with PRC, and at the same time, it's opening up the possibility of stronger relationships, not only with Taiwan, but with other like-minded countries in Asia and the Indo-Pacific region. So I think the Huawei affair, it's taken up 3 or 4 years for the implications of that to really sink in. But I think that they are beginning to do so now, and that's one reason why for my optimism, that we can pursue stronger relationships, not only with Taiwan, but with other Asian democracies.
And you talk about friendship. I just want to go to a very personal level on that. There's no better way to understand that friendship than just to visit. And, you know, having been there in September as the last of the quarantine requirements were ebbing away, it's high time for people interested to go to Taiwan and see for themselves. What I always find amazing, you know, I was there when martial law was imposed. I saw it in place in 1986. And I saw on the National Day how tanks would roll on the streets of Taipei to show its military posture. That's all changed. I mean, Taiwan, you cannot get into a taxi without a very fast-moving conversation, sometimes critical of the government, sometimes supportive. The media, I know that you've articulated real concerns about the media, but it's not because of the rule of law that there is a proliferation of media opinions. Of course, there's two major political parties and high participation rates in elections. These things are things that you would, if it didn't already exist, you'd be at pains to create in terms of a real flourishing democracy. And there it is. There it is in that little island, which you call the Forbidden Nation, Jonathan. So let's go.
The east coast of Taiwan and the central Matador, two of the great undersung tourist destinations for Asia. They're brilliant. They're magnificent. And I don't think that they nearly enough attention, Canadian tourists in Asia. They're brilliant.
And I'm guessing, Angel, that there's a certain office that will issue visas occasionally if Canadians want to go there.
Do you want visa free access, don't we?
Yes. Canadian passport holder can have visa waiver for 3 months if you want to visit Taiwan for with less than 90 days.
Right. But if you want to work there, there's an option as well.
Yeah, you can apply for a working holiday visa. And also, there's all kinds of honoring commercial obligation and tourist visa, etc., depending on your visit.
Right. Well, I know we're nearing the end of our hour, and we're going to be allowing our audience members to get exposure to great panelists to speak about the issues of our era, like you, Angel, and you, Jonathan. But what do they do if they want to dive more deeply? Let me start with two or three books that I think are worthy of people's consideration. And I don't want you to have to promote your own books, Jonathan, so bring to the floor again, Forbidden Nation, A History of Taiwan, which is just an excellent description of the history of language, economic patterns, politics, foreign affairs, written in a very readable style. And then Claws of the Panda, I mentioned that my copy's been purloined by my son, but it's behind you, Jonathan. And then your 2020 book, Restore Democracy, which is, let's say, a more sweeping description of the state of democracy, not just in Taiwan, but around the world. And then let me add one more book, which I think may be germane to all of our episodes because it relates to citizenship and leadership. And it's a book by David Brooks. This is called The Road to Character. And I've always thought that character is core to good leadership and that we should be promoting good character in our leaders. So over to you, Angel. What do you have to recommend for our audience?
Okay, if you want to just read short articles and to understand more about the international geopolitical situation between US, China over Taiwan, I would suggest the Taiwan series report by Toronto Star journalist Joanna Cho. She recently visited Taiwan at the end of August to have a lot of interviews with think tank scholars, with TSMC, the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing company representative, and also some government official on a lot of issues. And she continued to write a series of report on that, and very deep and thorough. And the second is the Globe and Mail reports by Stephen Chase. He has a lot of reports on the Chinese interference into Canadian politics. And also Sam Cooper, the global news reporter, he has a thorough analysis on the Chinese interference into Canadian politics too. And the other book that is similar to Jonathan's Claws of a Panda is the Australian author Clive Hamilton's Silent Invasion, How China is Turning Australia into a Puppet State. And I think it's very detailed about how United Front has influenced at the foreign politics, and also including Taiwan. And also the last one is the recent books, Surveillance State, Inside China's Quest to Launch a New Era of Social Control. I have not started reading it yet, but I bought one copy. I have a, tomorrow is a holiday, Remembrance Day, so I will try to take a look at it.
And who's the author of that?
Josh King.
All right.
Only Salim.
So that's a lot of homework, and don't worry, audience members, if you weren't able to keep up, we will be publishing on our website this list of Angel's recommendations. And Jonathan's, what do you have to suggest, Jonathan?
I just kept the back of what Angel said about Clive Hamilton's book. As the author of the panel, I found this rather interesting. We didn't know each other, we had no communication, but his book came out at roughly the same time as mine. We've subsequently met and we've exchanged emails, but it was, as you can imagine, it was quite reassuring for me to discover that that somebody was writing in Australia, who I didn't know anything about, was writing a book which set out almost exactly the same game plan by the Chinese Communist Party. You know, when you write a book like this, you always back of your mind think, oh, have I got this right, or am I exaggerating, or whatever. But so it was very reassuring when Clive's book came out at almost exactly the same time as mine and said exactly the same thing. I'm not going to take up too much of the time about this. I think a really important book to understand the current the Chinese Communist Party today is this book. It's quite big, and as you can see, I've many notes on it. But this is a compilation of all the Communist Party internal documents and reports of internal meetings in the period May, June, and into July in 1989. It describes what was happening all around the country. We know about Tiananmen Square and the massacre there and the protests there. What we don't or often ignore is that this happened all over the country, all the major cities, about 200 cities. There were similar demonstrations by people demanding reform. And the reason why martial law was introduced was because it was a national uprising. But then what gets interesting is reading the accounts of the party meetings afterwards, when they debated how to respond in the long term. And they decided very quickly, over a period of really relatively few days, in an intense meeting, that they would never allow again any organization to rise and to grow that threatened to become a national organization and threatened the one-party state. So everything that has happened really since 1989 has reinforced the Chinese Communist Party commitment to a one-party state and are now, of course, an increasingly authoritarian. I think this is a very good book to understand what is going on in China now, even 30 years, 40 years later.
Jonathan, you were mentioning Isle of Formosa, perhaps, is another one?
There's a this was one of the books I used in as one of, I've got a whole stack of others. This is a very good compilation of the early history of Taiwan, Formosa, as it was then called, starting with the end of the last ice age 20,000 years ago, when it emerged out of glaciers. It's called The Island of Formosa, Past and Present. It's written by an American, James Davidson, and published in 1903. So it's an old book, but it gives the picture of Taiwan, Formosa, as a place which had for hundreds of years been a refuge for people coming from north, south, east, and west, and arriving on the island, integrating and creating a new distinct culture. Even going back to 1903, that comes out. And I think that is the story of Taiwan. It is a collection of cultures and peoples from various places who have got together and formed what is now a remarkable place. If for people who are just interested in what's happened since the end of the Second World War, the period immediately afterward, 1945, 1949, when Chiang Kai-shek first his army went over to displace the Japanese after the Japanese surrender, but then how that collapsed into huge internal ructions, which didn't really resolve themselves until in the late 80s, when martial law was ended and multi-party democracy began to be introduced. That book is called Formosa Betrayed. It's by another American, George Kerr. It's a very, very good first-hand account. He was, I think, in an aid agency at the end of the war, one of those sent by the United Nations. And he wrote first-hand accounts of the the riots that started in Taipei and then spread across the country that led to the introduction of martial law and what is called the White Terror. And of course, many of the political leaders now in the democracy movement and in the Democratic People's Party, but in the democracy movement generally, many of those people were victims of the White Terror during the period of martial law. So Formosa Portrayed is a good introduction to the pressures that have created the current political scene.
Well, I think that that's been said before, a bulwark of democracy is an informed citizenry, and Jonathan and Angel, you've helped inform our audience tonight. You're both very dedicated to the values of freedom and peace, and we really appreciate your insights. You have mentioned some specific things, and I always undulate between what can an individual do and what should a government do. I'm an individual who's served in government, and I'm now an individual again, and it just seems to me that those lines are blurred. That yes, we can support our members of parliament who want to get behind Michael Cooper's bill that you mentioned, Jonathan, that would review the Canada-Taiwan relation, just as the U.S. has a 107-page bill in front of it right now to do just that. Another initiative would be to get behind the bill to clamp down on foreign interference. That was introduced by MP Kenny Cho previously. He's no longer in the House, and someone needs to get behind that once again. We talked about the Japan-Canada Forum as a real good model that could be adapted to bring a new, more effective era in the Canada-Taiwan relationship. That's very specific. And Angel, you mentioned several forums where Canada ought to be not just quietly observing, but endorsing Taiwan's involvement, not just for the good of Taiwan, but for the good of Canada. So thank you for those insights. Really a fantastic evening. I hope that you've enjoyed the evening, that you'll come back December 8th, everybody, to hear David Bentall and Lynn Kanuka, same time, same channel. And with that, I'll just say, 谢谢, merci bien, thank you, and good night.